Welcome to the IPv6 Buzz podcast, where we dare to dive into the 128-bit address space wormhole. Hey, quick reminder that there's sponsorship opportunity available for IPv6 Bugs and all the other Packet Pusher podcast shows. So if you're interested, you can go to packetpushers.net/sponsorship for details. If you have IPv6 support in your product and you want to be featured on IPv6 Buzz, we'd really love to hear from you because we're always interested in hearing about IPv6. I'm Ed Horley. I'm here with my co-host Tom Coffey and Scott Hoag. And today we're going to talk about SD-WAN and IPv6 because, as you are probably the audience hears over and over again, SD-WAN is like a great topic for packet pushers and lots of shows on it, but not a lot of shows about SD-WAN and IPv6, right?
And why is that? What is the reason for that?
Well, I don't know. Maybe we should noodle our way through that one and talk through it. So I think one of the main reasons why is actually because there's not a lot of ubiquitous IPv6 support within SD-WAN, and it's probably a hard, you know, sort of corner edge case for a lot of SD-WAN providers because they were really trying to build features in other areas as opposed to the protocol. They were like, you know, V4 is ubiquitous. We should really concentrate on that. Let's not, you know, introduce yet another protocol problem. Let's solve the core business function problems that SD-WAN was really, you know, there to sort of address and then sort of build from that. But I don't know. What do you guys think? You know, Scott, Tom, what do you guys
think? I think you're right. I mean, if it's a highly competitive market, it's a race to deliver a minimum viable product, you deliver to the, you know, the list of requirements that, you know, 90 some percent of your, you know, enterprise customers have, which is not, you know, 5 years ago, it wasn't, they didn't have the requirement to have IPv6 running in a branch or even at the, you know, corporate headquarters location or even in their cloud where these overlays may be terminating. And so, you know, that was what they were doing. But we've often talked on this show and in other places about how if you're a vendor or you're a company deploying new technology, you wouldn't want to have IPv6 be an afterthought in the design. And I think that's what's happened is vendors release products. Now IPv6 is coming up as a requirement. Now they're having to add that to their product development schedule. Enterprises are deploying it and saying, well, now I have to go back and revisit my SD-WAN architecture because now of some unique characteristics of IPv6.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's exactly where things are at for the industry is there, and there's different maturity levels for each one of the SD-WAN products. We've seen this. Mm-hmm. Scott, you have some blog posts that talk about sort of some of this information for those that are interested. We'll put some notes in the show notes, but it's one of those things where everyone's sort of at a different maturity level and a different place. And let's be honest, the enterprises, you know, this is probably not the first thing that they were trying to tackle. Right? Mm-hmm. And so I think they're coming back and visiting it. And I think probably the place they're visiting the most may not be with the overlay portion, but the underlay portion, right? That internet edge connecting to your SD-WAN gear, because probably more than likely that's dual stack because they probably got like, hey, a cheap circuit from Comcast Business and it's got V6 turned on already, or they've got some other sort of broadband related circuit that they're making use of, and their service provider's like, yeah, we just turn on V6 automatically for that internet edge because it's just an internet access. And the service providers are doing this because they don't want to hand out so much V4. They can hand out as much V6 as they want.
Right. Yeah.
So it's just a structural change for them that way. And I think that's where the first set of changes are maybe happening for the SD-WAN. So I don't know. Scott, what do you think? I mean, you think that's
It's the address space for the front side VERF, you know, the public side of that SD-WAN appliance, whether it's physical or virtual at that branch, and, you know, the scarcity of addresses. You know, not only does the large enterprise have scarcity of addresses for branches, but then also for the underlay, and the service providers are struggling with, you know, plentiful supply of public address space, because that needs to go over the direct internet access to the branch, needs to go over the internet, and it needs to have a public address. And so if you get an SD-WAN from a service provider, are they not giving you a static address? Is it dynamic? I mean, you'd hope that it would be static because you're relying upon it to build this underlay.
Yeah, but not necessarily, right? Mm-hmm. so that's the hard part. And then I don't think that's unique with V6 either, unless you have a business class service. Like it's common even today for V6 to change out for you. You know, if you're just using residential service, you could get a new prefix. So I don't think that's a unique V4 or V6 problem, but it's definitely an issue in terms of how much address space you may have available to you, and maybe maybe impacts how your design would actually work about sort of site-to-site transport and getting from one branch location to another branch location. So there's definitely some impacts around how some of that would work. And then there's the oddity around V6 around some of the performance benefits that you might get around that because of less peering hops, right? And so you might actually get a faster connection across your V6 than your V4, which sounds oddly strange, even though it's going across the first leg of the same circuit, right? The same physical infrastructure.
Yeah, and also you may be terminating some of these tunnels in a cloud. Mm-hmm. And so you're also relying upon that cloud to give you a public V4 address space to terminate these things. One little network automation script reboot something, if those addresses get relinquished and everything's homed in statically defined to an address, not a fully qualified domain name, you're not using DNS for these things, and that address disappears, now where are you? and then there's all these NATs that are in the way, right? There's a NAT at the branch, there's a NAT in your cloud, there's a NAT at your headquarters or other, you know, hubs or other data centers. There's all these little NATs.
Well, and so let's talk about that quickly, because that's a good pivot point, because NATs are actually a pro and a con. So they're a pro from the V4 standpoint, because they give you that sort of stable address space to run on the V4 side for that branch location without really caring about your V4 address on that, you know, public VRF side, right? Of like, I can have multiple internet connections, all with different public IP V4 addresses, all with different gateways as next hop upstream. And I'm going to balance traffic and play with my route tables and do all sorts of software-defined forwarding within my infrastructure. But my end hosts have zero visibility or insight into anything going on. And so NAT provides them good transparency, multiple tunnels to source from and terminate to. Like, there's definitely some advantages in terms of what's being provided there. In fact, I think you could say at core, that principal design was really built, you know, first with Cisco with DMVPN, right? And then many folks said, like, we can do better next generation, right, of doing that up at the application layer and making it more sophisticated. But it's one of the structural advantages you actually get with an SD-WAN architecture, is that local internet hop-off, that control of the tunnels and which ones and how much traffic steering you want to do over each one of them. And that really does sort of protect you behind the scenes of keeping a consistent set of addressing within the branch. Without getting more complex. And maybe I'm overcorrecting on that. No, but
yeah, that's exactly it. And thankfully, we have someone with us who knows a lot about IPv6 addressing and strategy.
I don't know who you're talking about.
Because Tom, the issue here is, well, if in the past I've just used RFC 1918 address space for the branch and let the SD-WAN device or whatever that stateful gateway is there handle the NAT, so what address space do I put inside my branch? Global, would you recommend unique local, Tom?
Well, but then we're back to the, you know, what problem are you trying to solve question that should be asked initially. And in particular, in terms of what the folks that are actually having to manage this installation, what do they have to keep in mind with IPv6? Like, IPv4 is just such an afterthought. Like, you don't think about it operationally in the same way that you're required to think about IPv6. Because the level of support varies, right? So then if you're talking about vendors that have different levels of SD-WAN support, you have to figure that out first, because you architecturally, you may not have all the options that, you know, you have that you're just taking for granted in IPv4, or you, that there are different ways to do things in IPv6. Some are better than others, but you may actually be hemmed in by what the vendor support level is to use one over the other. Because, you know, the general recommendation of avoiding, like, ULA addressing as an example, that it doesn't really gain you anything, and it gets you, it moves you away from having to use NATs and IPv6 and all of that is generally considered to the good where we're architecting IPv6 networks. But again, you know, it's a very, we're talking about a part of the network that we haven't necessarily defined in terms of how it's going to be impacted by the presence or the absence of V6 support.
Yeah. So decades ago, we built extranets, as we called them, and they were IPsec tunnels between locations. They were land-to-land tunnels.
Yep.
And branches got turned up with broadband internet service, maybe as a backup to a MPLS or, oh gosh, an old frame relay circuit.
I'm right there with you.
Yes. And we treated it kind of as a secondary, you know, class of service. And so we needed public V4 non-changing addresses for those branches. But I know, you know, large enterprises had a difficult time getting public non-changing static addresses for all these sites, and they paid a premium for that, an additional $5, $10, $15, $20, $50, $100 a month for those static addresses. And the prices have just gone up as contracts have negotiated and V4 addresses become more scarce. And even some providers say, we can't give you a non-changing address. Just assume it's going to be dynamic. And so one solution back, you know, a decade ago was, why don't you turn up your VPN using IPv6 as the transport, and then inside of that tunnel, send your V4 traffic. Use V6 as the global, static, non-changing, plentiful address space to build those IPsec tunnels and then tunnel over. So we're back to the same issue here. So when you have branch offices with direct internet access, you may have a static or a dynamic V4 address, but the V6 address would be static and it's global address space, provider assigned. So you kind of have some lock in there to the provider on that public facing side of the SD-WAN, you know, branch. But what's nice is it doesn't overlap with anything because it's V6, it's global address space, it's unique.
Right.
So just thinking about the inside versus the outside of that SD-WAN device at the appliance, how would you prefer to use one address space or a different one in which conditions or situations?
Well, I think, you know, you really have to look at the operational model, and that's again where do we have enough maturity on the operational model with the other areas of the enterprise network? You know, I wish I could say absolutely yes, go forth with SD-WAN and IPv6 and be prosperous. Yeah, I know we all do, right? And to be fair, there's a lot of territory to cover outside of the, I don't want to call SD-WAN and remote, you know, a corner case, but in terms of IPv6 operation, it certainly ends up being an afterthought in many cases. Mm-hmm. But the afterthought, the afterthinking, as it were, you know, is only as strong as the operational experience of the folks that are having to manage that solution. And where IPv6 is concerned, do they know what their options are? Do they know? Because there are certainly arguments to be able to get away with using, you know, ULA space. In the case of standard enterprise network, you want to avoid that at all costs. And in, you know, 99% of the cases, especially if there's, you know, no overwhelming security reason to even think twice about ULA. But, you know, I don't know what that looks like from the perspective of an enterprise engineer who's been tasked with deploying SD-WAN and doesn't have the foundation for IPv6 architecture to really know even what to ask.
Yeah, that's
right. Because yeah, an enterprise network engineer may say, I've read Tom's book. It says I should be using provider independent address space that I've been given for my branches. And if I want to use that on the public side for my direct internet access provider at my branch, well, now I need the smallest block that I could advertise potentially as a /48. So now I've disaggregated my provider independent address space to put a /48 at that site and then hope that service provider will route that or some way.
Well, and then you end up in a weird case condition. This assumes that we're going to run BGP and our AS at the branch location. So you got enough horsepower to do that, that you're going to advertise your 48, that you're going to assign address space for basically global, you know, global unicast out of your provider independent address space on your site location, and that you understand all the principal positions about how to sort of make it highly available and do all of that and provide multiple circuits, and that all your providers that you're going to connect in there are going to take that route. Because your SD-WAN solution doesn't work if they won't take that route, right? And so this becomes problematic. But the reverse is true too, because this is where the challenge is for the architect, right? I think the problem space you're bringing up, which is, okay, that's great. We'll use provider assigned addresses. I've got three service providers. Which one do I number into for my on-site LAN?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Do I do all three addresses? Do I do one? Do I take my provider independent space, assign it there, and then do, God forbid, you know, NPT V6 or NAT 6.6
and
translate it to whichever one it's going out of.
Yeah, because you want to keep it symmetric. You need it to come back symmetrically back to the exit point.
And of course, it's the layer. Now we're at layer 8 of the OSI model, right? Because it's like, you're not going to do any of that related to what's
religion now.
Yeah. Well, no, it's not that. It's just, it's that we're not going to do anything related to what the best path is or symmetric routing, asymmetric routing or state at the edge or any of that. It's going to be who am I stuck with for the longest contract so that I won't have to renumber.
Yes.
That's so true. I mean,
it's your depreciation schedule is governing your architecture.
That's right.
But I think, you know, one of the weird sticking points that everyone gets into and noodle their way through, because I sort of agree with Tom. ULA is not my first choice for doing it. I can understand some operational issues around why you may want to do it in certain use cases. But as we've reiterated on the show many times, IPv4 is actually preferred over, you know, ULA. So your behaviors are probably not going to be what you expect. So the reality is you may end up picking a particular, especially if you only have like a dedicated internet circuit from one provider at that location, and really you have like MPLS as a second backup. You may actually address into that PA space and then just accept that as a route coming across your SD-WAN as saying like, yeah, that's, you know, those folks, you have to go across the tunnel to get to them. Right. And then you're okay because you're actually accepting that provider's assigned address space as a route into yourself internally as IPv6 as a trusted route effectively. They're one hop away from you and they are part of our network because we own that address space, whatever the 56 or the 52 that they assign you to use for your site, or hopefully a 48, you know, that would be one way to tackle it. I think the big problem that people noodle on is they're like, I want to use my PI space, but I don't want to do BGP. And then that becomes like the, like, I want to use my address space because I own it and Aaron assigned it to me or Ripe assigned it to me or LACNIC assigned it to me. So I should be using it because, you know, we have that ownership principle. And then what do you do then? And there's no easy answers. That's sitting down on a whiteboard and figuring out what your use cases are, figuring out how your SD-WAN performs, figuring out like, you know, all sorts of different use cases about how you're doing that. Maybe you don't make your, maybe local internet hop off is actually a NAT translation from your PI space to a PA space.
Well, and, yeah, absolutely. And then
gosh
and
forbid.
Exactly. But we're, you know, as IPv6 evangelists, I'm up here banging the pulpit saying you can bring all of your operations under, you know, one addressing scheme, and that's for every part of the network, you know. And so of course right away it's like, okay, well here's a solution that doesn't allow me to do that or doesn't allow me to do that in a trivial way. And
right.
So that's challenging. And then if you don't have that foundation as we talked about, then you don't really know what the right answer is.
Right. Well, that's why you're paid the big dollars to do design and architecture work.
Am I really, though? Would I be on this podcast with you? Of course I would.
Yes. Of course you would. Yeah, but you, is ULA ever the right answer? ACK. ULA. Even just the word ULA does not sound pleasing. It sounds like that little thing that hangs out down in the back of your throat. But really, I think you could go without and have a happy and healthy life without it. But
now we're going to get a bunch of haters from a bunch of biology
haters.
People.
That thing serves a function. I guess the design decision is, if you want to use PI space, do you run a routing protocol, a control plane in your overlay to advertise it? Or do you have to NAT it somehow statefully to preserve symmetry?
Right. And what's the expectation on redundancy too? Do you need, so here's a good example. Like you could pick a provider on one side, pick a redundant connection, but the redundant connection is only for the purpose of a tunnel back to your corporate location, pass the default route. If your local internet hop off provider disappears, you're still going to get a default route that brings you across the tunnel across the other provider, drops you off the corporate side and pushes you through for NAT translation through there. That gets weird because suddenly you got provider assigned address space that you're advertising out of your main AS, out of a service provider that probably doesn't own that address space. So there's like all sorts of, you have to noodle your way through this. It's not a trivial sort of thing to sort of think through.
So. Yeah, I think we have to explain a little bit more. We use the term NAT 6.6, but that is not an RFC. It's not a defined standard. So if your vendor says they're doing NAT 6.6 or something, you should ask them how. They may be doing it and it's not a standard. And so if you had two vendors and you're expecting interoperability, you might have some challenges because they've gone and just done something maybe the old way they did masquerading or something. And well, who knows how, they've built it or handled it. Also, yep. NPT v6, you may not have very many vendors who support either network prefix translation v6 or NAT 6.6.
Know the difference.
And also, the danger of NPT v6 is what gives it its speed is that it's stateless.
Yeah.
So there are many protocols that may not behave properly through a stateless function like that.
Yeah, there's a whole set, and because it's stateless, it intentionally does not have any quote unquote mm-hmm. fix ups the way that mm-hmm. a NAT 6.6 or a NAT 4.6, 6.4 or 4.4 would have, mm-hmm. where they're looking in the application and saying we need to do something quickly on this device, this translation device, to mm-hmm. instantiate or support the application protocol. NPT v6 does not care about that. Its only function is to change one prefix to another prefix, and that is it. And it doesn't do checksum. It doesn't do, it's wire speed, baby, as fast as you can, distributed. It's really designed for scale around being able to do that from a functional sort of problem space. And I think that's a mismatch versus what enterprises are probably looking for. Right. That's just my gut feeling, but you know.
So what do you guys think? I mean, might an enterprise be better off trying to go V6 only and do DNS 6.4, NAT 6.4? Because applications seem to handle that pretty well.
Yeah.
Do you think you'd be better off trying to go V6 only in a branch with NAT 6.4, DNS 6.4? Or is that just crazy talk?
Our answer is yes, because with SD-WAN, every solution is potentially there to allow us to deploy IPv6. That's like... the problem that we're trying to solve is to get more IPv6 on the network. So of course, Scott, the answer is yes, absolutely.
IPv6? Yes. What's your question?
Yes, that's softballs. We're lobbing softballs here. Right. But I think the point is that I think there's the interesting change that's going to happen for a lot of folks, I think, when they look at SD-WAN, is SD-WAN doesn't typically involve looking at routing protocol at the edge in the same way that we look at it from a service provider basis. And I think this is going to change a little bit as some of the behaviors as... more and more folks adopt SD-WAN related sets of technologies, they may have to take into consideration more and more opportunity to do simple eBGP, PI space redundancies around service providers. And service providers are going to be asking more and more for, hey, can you start moving your bits further to the left? A 48 is great. A 44 is better. Mm-hmm. Maybe a 40 is going to help in terms of maybe solving the problem space. Or you may even see these SD-WAN providers who are doing it as a managed service provider basis assigning out of their address pool a much larger aggregate base of addresses and saying like, hey, you know, example.com, we're giving you, you know, a much larger address allocation of 36, and we're going to address you out of all of that, and we expect to run and operate for this for you at your site locations. That will be your global unicast addresses that you use locally on link. And then you're simply going to ingest that as a route from a peering basis directly into your network. We just consider that address space part of your corporate network. Yeah. And we just assign it to you. I don't know what you guys think about that, but it seems like that might be a direction that like these managed services SD-WAN providers are going to have to move towards, right?
Yeah, I think it's always good advice for an enterprise architect, network engineer to ask their vendors where they stand, because if the SD-WAN vendor they chose, their products don't support IPv6. They should know that sooner rather than later. They might also ask their broadband ISP, hey, did I automatically get IPv6 when I turned up all these direct internet access links? And what might that address space be? They might have just done it and not told the enterprise what the addresses were. And so it's good to know where you stand, because if you were an early adopter and you rolled out SD-WAN 4 or 5 years ago, and you know, that's your 1.0 SD-WAN. Now you're rethinking the architecture and thinking longer term with IPv6 and cloud and maybe a SASE component thrown in there. Now you're thinking, now I really do want a global unique address space for all these things. Now you're starting to think a little deeper and towards SD-WAN 2.0 or whatever that might be.
Well, and I think to dovetail on that, Scott, because I mean, security is your thing, like you want to have a uniform set of policies you can apply through SD-WAN, and having a global mm-hmm. unicast address space that's consistent and that you know you understand how you can put some logic around that to be able to write, you know, cleaner policy models to help support what you're doing throughout your architecture. So I think that's one of the big advantages you're going to get also, versus writing for the same 10.0 address space that you know nothing about the branch, because in reality, you could have overlapping RFC 1918 because you're NATing it three times, right? So, right. So that is another structural advantage you need to think about from an SD-WAN standpoint, in terms of what you're going to design and build. I don't think this is easy, and I have not seen. I mean, this is just me. I dig around on some of the SD-WAN vendor sites looking for documentation, deployment stuff, and things of that nature. Not seen a lot of them do really complex write-ups on architectural deployments for V6. Mm-hmm. It's usually a pretty simple, you know, one and done, straightforward. Like, here's a branch, here's your head end site, and we've got a single source provider, and here's V6 working, right?
Zero touch provisioning works, and that's about it. Yeah.
Right. And that's about it. And they're not really going over, like, you've got three service providers or you've got four service providers at the site location. You want to balance these applications. Here's the global unicast address space that you use. I haven't seen a lot of topology write-ups around that. I think one of the reasons why is the problem space is relatively hard. So that's just a guess, or we just really haven't gotten there because no one's really gotten it functional in the way that they think is the right way to tell people to deploy it.
Maybe a little more of the latter. And again,
probably more of the latter.
more of the latter, just based on how much SD-WAN deployment and how much V6, how much V6 you've gotten into your SD-WAN deployment, and vice versa.
Right. Yeah. I think that's fair. Did you guys want to noodle a little bit? I guess I realized we talked straight over NPT V6 versus NAT 6.6. Really didn't explain it at all.
Go ahead, Ed. Yeah. The difference.
Maybe we just talk through it, because it's. I don't know if it's a one and done explanation, but I had mentioned that NPT V6 is basically replacing prefixes. So one of the criteria about that, as you go through this translation device, whether that's a router or an SD-WAN appliance or whatever else, is as it's you're having one for one. So if you've got a 48 that's running at the site, you need a 48 on the front side to translate to. That means you need a whole nother 48. Whole new prefix to do that. It doesn't change any of the lower 64 bits. It just runs it right through that, and you're off to the races. So that's basically how it quickly does this and how it can do it statelessly. And the nice thing about the stateless aspect is that it can be asymmetric, right? We can have different paths to come back and forward. And as long as we have NPT V6 running in the same sort of right locations within our network, we can actually have asymmetrical traffic and still have NPT V6 work properly, which is one of the great advantages. And like Scott mentioned, it's stateless. And I'm going to punt it to you for NAT 6.6 because you do way more work on NAT 6.6 than I do.
Sure. Yeah. The other thing about NPT V6, it's only changing the source address. So it takes the source address of one packet and converts only the first 48 bits from whatever the private address to was the public. And it just goes in the outbound direction. It just changes the 48. It keeps the rest of the quote, you know, subnet, the prefix, and the interface identifier, just copies those over and sends them out. Yep. It doesn't change anything else in the header or any of the, it doesn't do TCP, UDP, header checksums. It doesn't change any of that. And so when it comes back, then it just does the reverse and it just mindlessly, and it doesn't even keep state about anything.
Yep.
So NAT 6.6 is like what we're familiar with, NAT 4.4. It will do the, you know, it's translating the source address, and it can do overload or do a PAT type function. So all the outbound traffic is going to the single global V6 address on the outside of your firewall, you know, and it can maintain state, and it has to maintain state because the return traffic, it needs to change the TCP, you know, source address and keep all that working. And so it has to keep a state table to match who's talking to who.
Can I just say how grateful I am that we can overload, since we only got 1.8 times 10 to the 19th addresses available?
Well, hey, you never know when you might need more. So
you need the extra 65,000 some odd port numbers to add on there. What are you being cheap, Tom?
How big does your pool need to be, Tom? 18 quintillion could be your pool size.
Sorry, I couldn't resist.
Right, Tom. Old habits die hard, right? It's NAT 4.4 just with V6. And there are firewalls that say they can do NAT 6.6. You can do it with IP tables. There's a variety of things you can do. You can make systems kind of work with NAT 6.6.
Yeah.
And some vendors will even say that they do support it. And it's really just taking the old algorithms that they've always done and just applying them to IPv6.
with some extra special sauce, lettuce, cheese.
I don't know.
Yeah. On a new bun. I don't know. I think this is the challenge around both of these sets of technologies is that not widely supported, not standards-based, not agreed to in terms of how you're seeing them commonly deployed and used in architectures. Mm-hmm. And so these cause a whole set of ongoing challenges. And these are both the pros and cons of where I think things sit for V6 on a global basis, is there's not operational maturity and architecture design maturity around where these things fit in, mm-hmm. how we need to be using them or consuming them, if we should at all, and how they're being leveraged for, with technologies like SD-WAN and other technologies that are out there. Mm-hmm.
An enterprise may also be confused, well, if I use a secure web gateway, all my end users are going out to the internet. They pass through this secure web gateway proxy. Maybe it does some caching. Maybe it prevents mm-hmm. my end users from going to malicious sites on the internet. So it's getting some threat intelligence or something and protecting people from going to bad site dot, you know, gov or com or net or something. So that outbound secure web gateway is like an outbound proxy in a sense too. And that has, it's stateful, but it has that.
Yeah, it's very similar.
Of
yeah.
similars in that it's stateful and it's translating the, and it's making a net new connection on the outbound side.
Yeah, so that's the distinction, right? Is that there's mm-hmm. a TCP termination that's actually happening on that web proxy device, right? And a net new session's being opened on the other outbound interface to sort of do that. So yeah, I agree. Well, unlike V6, we've run out of space for the podcast. So hey, Scott, how can folks find you on the internet?
At Scott Hoag on Twitter. Good place to find me.
Okay. Tom?
Yeah, on Twitter as well, at IPv6 Tom.
Awesome. Well, you can hit me up at Ehorley, and you can reach the IPv6 Buzz podcast at Twitter at IPv6 Buzz. So thanks for listening to the IPv6 Buzz. You can find us on the Packet Pushers or any of your favorite podcast apps. Just search for IPv6 Buzz. If you like the show, please give us a rating on iTunes. Hopefully you're listening on Spotify or any of the other podcasting app platforms. And if you like the podcast, we really recommend you check out Heavy Networking, Day 2 Cloud, Network Break. There's just tons of great technical content over at packetpushers.net. So long, and until next time, we'll see you on the internet. The IPv6 internet, that is.
Thanks for listening to IPv6 Buzz, a podcast devoted to truth, justice, and 128 bits of address space. IPv6.